Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So today we're on text 18, which starts on page 29, the very bottom. Sri Rajavacha. Apyesha Vangshan Rajarshin. Punya Shlokan Mahatmanaha. Anuvartitas Vidyashasa. Sadhu Vadena Sattamaha. Sri Rajavacha, Apyesha Vangshan Rajarshin, Punya Shlokan Mahatmanaha, Anuvartitas Vidyashasa, Sadhu Vadena Sattamaha, Sri Rajavacha, Apyesha Vangshan Rajarshin. Punya Shlokan Mahatmanaha. Anuvartitas Vidyashasa. Sadhu Vadena Sattamaha. Apyesha Vangshan Rajarshin. Punya Shlokan Mahatmanaha.
Anuvartita Svidyasyasa.
Anuvartita Svidyasyasa.
Sadhu Vadena Sattamaha.
Sadhu Vadena Sattamaha.
Sri Raja Uvacha.
Apyesha Vangshan Rajarshin. Punya Shlokan Mahatmanaha. Anuvartita Svidyashasa. Sadhu Vadena Sattamaha.
Sri Raja Vacha.
Apyesha Vangshan Rajarshin.
Punya Shlokan Mahatmanaha.
Anuvartita Svidyashasa.
Sadhu Vadena Sattamaha.
Sri Raja Vacha.
Apyesha Vangshan Rajarshin.
Punya Shlokan Mahatmanaha.
Anuvartita Svidyashasa. Sadhu Vadena Sattamaha.
Excuse me. Sri Raja, the all good king. Maharaj Yudhishthir Uvacha said, Api, whether, Eshaha, this, Vangshan, family, Raja Rishin, of saintly kings, Punya Shlokan, pious by the very name, Maha Atmanaha, all great souls, Anuvartita, follower. Swit, will it be? Yashasa, by achievements. Sadhu Vadena, by glorification. Sattamaha, O great souls. Translation. The good king Yudhishthir inquired, O great souls, will he become as saintly a king, as pious in his very name, and as famous and glorified in his achievements as others who appeared in this great royal family? Please repeat. The good king Yudhishthira inquired, O great souls, will he become as saintly a king, as pious in his very name, and as famous and glorified in his achievements, as others who appeared in this great royal family? Purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. The forefathers of King Yudhishthir were all great saintly kings, pious and glorified by their great achievements. They were all saints on the royal throne, and therefore all the members of the state were happy, pious, well-behaved, prosperous, and spiritually enlightened. Under strict guidance of the great souls and spiritual injunctions, such great saintly kings were trained up, and as a result, the kingdom was full of saintly persons and was a happy land of spiritual life. Maharaj Yudhishthir was himself a replica of his ancestors, and he desired that the next king after him become exactly like his great forefathers. He was happy to learn from the learned brahmanas that by astrological calculations the child would be born a first-grade devotee of the Lord, and more confidentially he wanted to know whether the child was going to follow in the footsteps of his great forefathers. That is the way of the monarchical state. The reigning king should be a pious, chivalrous devotee of the Lord and fear personified for the upstarts. He must also leave an heir apparent equally qualified to rule over the innocent citizens. In the modern setup of the democratic states, the people themselves are fallen to the qualities of the Shudras or less, and the government is run by their representative who is ignorant of the scriptural mode of administrative education. Thus, the whole atmosphere is surcharged with Shudra qualities manifested by lust and avarice. Such administrators quarrel every day among themselves. The cabinet of ministers changes often due to party and group selfishness. Everyone wants to exploit the state resources till he dies. No one retires from political life unless forced to do so. How can such low-grade men do good to the people? The result is corruption, intrigue, and hypocrisy. They should learn from the Srimad Bhagavatam how ideal the administrators must be before they can be given charge of different posts. So now we'll read from the yellow, second yellow tab, our Mangala Charanam. Om Jnana Timirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militang Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Mano Bhishtang Stapitang Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kata Mahyam Tadati Svapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalang Shri Gurun Vaishnavangscha Shri Rupang Sagrajatang Sahagana Raghunathan Vitang Tang Sajivam Sadvetam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devang Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakan Vitangscha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Preshtaya Bhutale Shri Mate Bhaktivedanta Swaminiti Namine Namaste Sarasvate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Deshatarine Shri Shri Navadvipa Parapradipa Sandipyamana Satato Bhuviha Chetastamo Hanti Hyasyatnat Tankirtayamak Prabhupada Devam Shri Bhakti Siddhanta Prachoditak Shri Vyasadya Koshang Kushalang Kripaluhu Sanmlecha Vagdesha Chaye Dadhyas Tankirta Yamak Prabhupada Devam Achadyate Yat Paratarka Drishya Govinda Murt Yujvala Bhaskarena Advaita Kadyota Kulang Jagatyang Tankirta Yamak Prabhupada Devam yasya eva yatnena purana raja gangamala keshava keli hansa sat stotra ratna viti halolek pankirtayama prabhupada devam Sri Radhika Krishna Padara Vinde Sahasra Hritsu Shatamandirishu Aropayad Yo Madhure Prativyam Tankirtayama Prabhupada Devam Kaushalya Daryasya Sahasra Shastra Shastrati Varshai Pratihanyate Ye Chanda Kaler Mohak Chamur Yatena Tankirtayama Prabhupada Devam Na Nala Sadgora Sudha Prakasha Halakshot stapita eva yena Krishnanu chinta jana sangha vrikshas tankirtayama prabhupada devam yo nitya da jivati daivikeshu kishashu sikshashu tusangami kripam budhir nanda sutashitatma tankirtayama prabhupada devam nama om vishnu padaya krishna preshtaya bhutale Srimate Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Dinamine Sri Varshabhanavi Devi Daitaya Kripabdaye Krishna Sambandha Vijnana Daine Prabhave Namaha Madhur Yojvala Premadya Sri Rupanuga Bhaktida Sri Gaura Karuna Shakti Vigrahaya Namostute Namaste Gauravani Sri Murtaye Dinatadine Rupanuga Virudhapa Siddhanta Dvanta Harine Namo Gaura Kishoraya Sakshad Vairagya Murtaye Vipralambhara Sambhode Padambujayate Namaha Namo Bhakti Vinodaya Satchidananda Namine Gaura Shakti Swarupaya Rupanuga Varayate Gaura Abhir Bhava Bhumestvang Nirdeshta Sajjanapriyaha Vaishnava Sarva Bhoma Shri Jagannathaya Te Namaha Vancha Kalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patitanang Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Namo Mahavaranyaya Krishna Prema Pradayate Krishnaya Krishna Chaitanya Namne Gaura Tvishe Namaha Panchatattvatmakam Krishnang Bhaktarupa Swarupakam Bhakta Bhataram Bhakta Kyang Namami Bhakta Shaktikam Karuna Sindho Dina Bandho Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Jayatang Suratau Pangor Mama Manda Matergati Matsarvasva Padam Bhojao Radha Madana Mohanao Divyad Vrindaranya Kalpadrumadha Srimad Ratna Gara Singhasanastau Srimad Radha Srila Govinda Devau Krishtali Bhik Sevyamanau Smarami Sriman Rasara Sarambhi Vangshi Bhatta Tatastitaha Karshan Venus Vanayar Gopir Gopinatak Shriyestunaha Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vrindayai Tulsi Devyai Priyaye Keshavasya Cha Vishnu Bhakti Pradye Devi Satyai Bhattai Namo Namaha Shri Nishringha Jaya Nishringha Jaya Jaya Nishringha Prahladesha Jaya Padma Mukha Padma Bringha Matsamo Nasti Papatma Parihare Pilajame King Bruve Purushottama Yuvati Nang Yata Yuni Yunang Cha Yuvatau Yata Mano Bhi Ramate Tadvan Mano Me Ramatang Twai Bhumaus Kalati Padanang Bhumire Babanambanam Twai Jata Paradhanam Twameva Sharanang Prabho Govinda Vallabhe Radhe Prarthaye Twang Mahansada Twadiyamiti Jana Tu Govindo Mang Twayasaha Radhe Vrindavanadhishe Karunamrita Vahini Kripaya Nijapadabja Dasyang Mahyang Pradiyatam Vande Nanda Vrajastrinang Padarenu Mabhikshna Saha Yasang Hari Katod Gitang Punati Bhubanatrayam Nama Shreshtang Manumapichachi Putra Shatrasurupam Shri Rupang Tasyagra Jamurupuri Maturing Goshtavatim Radha Kundang Girivaram Mahoradhika Madhavashang Prapto yasya pratita kripaya shri gurung tanutosmi
Adadanas trinang dantai idam yache punak punaha Srimad rupa padam bhoja rajohang syam bhave bhave Hantaya madrir abala haridasya varyo yad brahma krishna charanas parasha pramodaha manang tanoti sahago ganayosta yuryat paniya suya vasakandara kandamulahi Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Rama Rama, Rama Hare Hare
Shri Rajovacha Apyesha Vangshan Rajarshin Punya Shlokan Mahatmanaha Anuvartita svidyashasa sadhu badena sattamaha. The good King Yudhishthira inquired, O great souls, will he become as saintly a king, as pious in his very name, and as famous and glorified in his achievements as others who appeared in this great royal family? So the scene here, the brahmanas are the new heir, scion of the family of King Pandu, King the Kuru dynasty, Parikshit Maharaj has been born, and King Yudhishthira is giving charity to brahmanas who are foretelling that this child will be a great devotee. He was protected in the womb from the invincible weapon hurled by Ashwatthama, by Krishna, and he will be a devotee of Krishna and a great personality. And now King Yudhishthira is inquiring further, Will his deeds be as great? Will his rule of the kingdom be great? Will his very name be pious the way his ancestors in the great royal family of King Yudhishthira were? And Srila Prabhupada is explaining how that the proper function in the monarchical state of the Vedic system is that the king should be a great saintly person, trained Rajarshi. Someone was saying something? Rajarshi. The king should be saintly and should, under the guidance of the scriptures and of the great, learned, wise counsel that he has from the Brahmana community, he should administer the state for the welfare of all beings. It's part of the duty of government, just like the duty of government is to administer justice, to protect us from the cut purses and muggers and burglars and criminals. So they protect people, they administer justice, they administer welfare, they make sure that no one is without a livelihood, too poor, too starving, and they also administer to the spiritual welfare of the people. It's the duty of the government to make sure that all of the people, including even the animals, are properly situated and cared for and no one is harmed. And part of that care is that they should have proper spiritual guidance so that they can prosecute the duty of human life, which is to get out of the cycle of birth and death and to achieve the love of Krishna, which is available in this human form of life. And therefore the government should be supporting those who are actually propagating the bona fide teachings of spiritual life from great scriptures like Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita. Just like now we're distributing Bhagavad Gita into the motel rooms of all the hotels and motels around the country. But actually, a saintly government should recognize that this is an important project and they should support it. We shouldn't have to go and beg people to give money to help us do it and stuff. The government should, it's an inexpensive program for them compared to some of the other things they do, to put Bhagavad Gitas into everyone's motel room so that the people can be actually trained in the principles of spiritual life. It sounds almost, to our modern ear, it sounds kind of almost old-fashioned, quaint, or even dangerous. You know, the word Rajarshi I've mentioned before in the Plato's Republic. Plato uses this the similar word in Greek that's translated as philosopher kings. He tells the story of a great city-state that's utopian society ruled by philosopher kings who are so wise and they know everything that's going on that they're able to look after the proper welfare of all the people. But other philosophers, for notably Karl Popper, sort of blamed the influence of this idea of philosopher kings on from Plato. On he blamed that the rise of tyrants in the 20th century, like Stalin and Hitler, and you know, Ayatollah Khomeini was inspired by reading Plato while he was in the 19, whatever it was, he was in exile in the 1930s or something like that, and living in Paris or somewhere. I forget now. Fifties, yeah. But he was inspired by his studies of Plato, and people are worried that, you know, if this better to, there aren't any, and maybe realistically there aren't any great saints, saintly kings, or they don't see any great saintly kings around, so they think better not to let someone be too glorified. It's better to keep everyone in this position as, you know, no better than anyone else. In the American history, you know, they, Hare Krishna. Okay, Hare Krishna, thank you for coming. In American history, they overthrew the British monarch, at least at ruling that as the ruling these colonies here. And they wanted to establish a new constitutional government, you know, after there was a period of the Articles of Confederation of the different colonies, and then in 1787 they ratified the U.S. Constitution. There had been a period of intellectual ferment when, you know, James Madison and others were writing these different papers about how the new form of government, for new federal government, should be formed. And one thing they put in the Constitution was that there should be no titles of nobility. They were afraid that if the new government could make noblemen, they would create an aristocracy. They were afraid that an aristocracy would wield too much power, and that, in fact, Thomas Paine, this sort of rabble-rousing author who wrote inspirational revolutionary things, he scathingly wrote about how the common people have a tendency, when someone has got a noble title, then people will automatically, even if they don't have noble qualities, people will ascribe to them those noble qualities because they've been called my lord or such, and it will keep them in slavery. So when the first president was elected, George Washington was elected president, John Adams was elected vice president, and he became the second president. But John Adams put forth in the Senate, you know, a first order of business, important thing when we have the new government. What shall we call the president? And he thought we need a title for him, a high-sounding title, and, you know, we have to call him, you know, His Excellency, the Protector of the People and the Constitution, and they were trying to think of the title, and he thought it was important that he had some important high-sounding title because he had to be on a station of other leaders of the world. But James Madison was against that idea, and he said no, he should just be the president. And George Washington decided that he was just going to be a citizen president, and he didn't want to be called His Excellency, His Royal, you know, whatever. Didn't need a big high sounding title. But for when the kings are saintly, it's natural for people to love them. It's almost like it's like a Jungian archetype, you know, that everybody shares in their consciousness practically this principle of the good king. And there are, you know, psychoanalytic people say, well, it comes from our experience in our pre-Oedipal stage when we imagine our father, or, you know, to be this big authoritarian figure or something. But somehow everybody has in this, or others say, you know, it relates to God. The king is a representative of God. And as you'll find that there in Shakespearean prose and things like that, that like his scepter shows the force of temporal power, the attribute to awed majesty, wherein doth dwell the fear and dread of kings. But mercy lies above this sceptered sway. It is enthroned in the hearts of men as an attribute of God himself. So the king's mercy is supposed to be showing or reflecting. And this is the classical idea that the hierarchy on the earthly plane reflects a hierarchy in the heavenly plane in the Mount Olympus or whatever, and that reflects a hierarchy in the Christian heaven of God and his angels and so forth. And this is the actual idea that there should be a sense that the administration, the seat of government, the seat of power of administration should be a person who's a representative of God, a saintly person who's a representative of God and is endowed with divine qualities because he's a pure devotee of God and being obedient to the will of God, then he can govern the earth with justice and also provide to all the people what they need in terms of love. So it's the duty of government that to actually provide for the spiritual welfare of beings as well. And we still have, like for example, in England, the monarch is also the head of the Church of England, you know. And they have this, but there was this whole history of the British, the English Reformation, and what happened with Henry VIII, and how there were Catholics and Protestants fighting, and Puritans who came here to found the United States, you know, in the Massachusetts Bay Colony and stuff. There had been, at the time that Lord Chaitanya was on Earth, in Europe, in Western Europe, everything had been under one Catholic Church. I mean, there were different kings, and for centuries they had, you know, jostled for political power with the Pope in Rome, who was also a separate king. But then, you know, for a couple centuries, in the 1400s, there was this Devotio Moderna. There was a new way of sort of interpreting and a more humanistic way of interpreting things, and it led to, in the early 1500s, like, all hell broke loose when people just rebelled from the hierarchy of the church and the way the church sold indulgences, and rich people could get, you know, forgiven for their sins by giving big donations, and it was all supporting this corrupt, or as seen by the Protestants anyway, this corrupt hierarchy of coming out of Rome, where a lot was, you know, based on political favors and things, and then the different kings who had to be, I mean, like even in the Middle Ages, you know, if a king was fighting with the church for some reason, you know, like they fought over whether the right to appoint bishops in their realm or, you know, whatever political reason, the Pope could threaten to excommunicate the king or even to excommunicate all the citizens in his kingdom. This is the way it was going in Western Europe. It was called an interdict. The Pope could issue an interdict, and he would say that all of the people in France now who are under are loyal to the monarch of the king of, you know, loyal to the king of France, they're no longer part of the community of the Church of Jesus Christ, the Catholic Church, and they're all going to have to go to hell. So this was a way, it was politics, you know. So in the Reformation, the different kings then started, or princes, you know, and city-states and things, started aligning with different church leaders of different reform groups, and there was all this bloody warfare and things, you know. The Calvin was in Geneva, and, you know, Luther was in Wurttemberg and in the German areas, and, you know, for 100 years there were all these wars of the different states fighting against each other, until by the end of when the dust settled, at the end of the Hundred Years' War, they had allegiances. They developed politics to such an extent that Catholic states and Protestant states might align themselves against other allegiances of Catholics and Protestant states. But at first it was all organized in terms of, the wars were organized in terms of religion. Sorry for that digression into European history. But out of that came this idea that the government has to be secular. You know, there was too much fighting and fanaticism over, you know, which party you were aligned with, which religious party you were aligned with. And to a certain extent, there had to be a means of just living. So in the U.S. Constitution, it's enshrined. Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. The federal government can't be, it can't support one particular religion. It can't be they can't declare that the United States is a Russian Orthodox country or a Jewish country or something like that, or a Hindu country. And it turns out that it's good for preaching because we're allowed freedom of religion. We're allowed to go around and tell people Krishna is God, and nobody can say, how dare you say that? This is a Christian country and you can't say that and you're going to jail or something like that. But this is the way it's developed, that we have our modern system of both democracy, where people are afraid of tyrannical rulers, and secularism, where people are afraid that the government will become the instrument of one particular religious faith at the expense of the genuine religious faith of other people. And I guess that's the key, is genuine religious faith, that when the king is actually an enlightened monarch, he can recognize who's a genuine spiritual person and promote such people and give charity. This is, you know, the king would support the actual enlightened people and give them charity and cows and land so that they could go on doing their job of teaching spiritual knowledge to the people in general without having to worry about how are they going to get food or how are they going to get... Of course, they don't need much because they're enlightened. But they can direct the use of wealth in, publication activities, for example, and so forth. So I brought with me today, I saw on Dandavats yesterday something that was the letters that Srila Prabhupada wrote to the President of the United States. And in 1972, 28th of June, Srila Prabhupada wrote to President Nixon, "My dear Mr. President, several thousand years ago, a great pious emperor ruled over this planet. He was descendant of the great Kuru dynasty and the grandson of Arjuna, the hero of Bhagavad Gita and the personal associate of the Lord Sri Krishna." So he's talking about Parikshit Maharaj, the grandson of Arjuna. "The people lived under his domain in peace. He provided protection for the people and the cows, as well as all other living entities. He engaged many brahmanas, spiritual leaders, to educate his people and advise him in all matters. The people were just and God-conscious. They had a good understanding of the meaning and purpose of life and lived in happiness and prosperity." In modern politics, nobody has a sense of what the purpose of life is. They say that's okay. Not everybody has to have the same purpose, but we can do business with each other, You just keep the rules okay, But as a result, what happens is that, even the people whose purpose is only to eat, drink, and be merry they become the more prominent and there's no one teaching that there's a higher purpose, or that teaching is left outside of, it's not allowed in the public sphere. "They respected their emperor and received kindness and benedictions from him. You are a great president of a great nation. In this age of unrest and quarrel, your strength, as well as the strength of your nation, will be lasting if it is built upon the pillars of spiritual knowledge and absolute truth." By the way, Nixon was raised in a Quaker family. When he was a kid, his parents would use they would say, "Thee, would thee get thy bowl of cereal off the table into the sink?" So... anyway, they were serious. They were serious enough about religion that they, and pacifism, as a family, as the Quaker Church was a church against, the Quaker was against the rebellion against religious authority. That the Quakers have meetings. They don't have any one priest stand in front of. They don't use any crosses or any symbols, and the idea is that it's just a congregation and they're all friends. Like there's a society of friends, but in the England during the time of Reformation in the 16th or 17th century, they were very I guess it was his name was Fox. They were really radical. They would blow up churches and stuff like that. And William Penn, who founded Pennsylvania, had become involved in that church, and he was able to get this land. His father had been a big admiral or something, and the king owed the father some. Anyway, too much history. I'm sorry about that. But Nixon had been from a very religious family. I am 76 years of age. And I am in the renounced order of life. I came to this country from India 6 years ago to introduce Krishna consciousness, the scientific process of spiritual life, to the English-speaking people of the Western world. Now, by the grace of Krishna, I have many thousands of disciples, young American and European boys and girls. Many of them have come to me bewildered, rebellious, and addicted to all sorts of sinful activities. Like so many of the young people today, they were lost and confused. Now they are all leading a disciplined and regulated life. They follow strict principles of spiritual life with no desire for intoxication of any kind or illicit sex life. They are always engaged in meaningful work serving God and their fellow man. They have become the flower of your country, and all over the world they are being treated with the highest respect. I would humbly like to request an interview with you to discuss the possibilities of my providing further service. My disciple Atreya Rishi Das, who was Mr. Marzatar of Arthur Young and Company, 277 Park Avenue, New York. So he's got a disciple who's got an MBA and he's working in a big accounting firm. Will assist your aides to arrange a suitable time and place for a meeting. I hope this meets you in best of health. Your ever well wisher, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami. Nixon never agreed to meet with Prabhupada. I don't know if there was ever any even a reply to this letter. Usually the White House, if anybody writes him a letter, you could be a 10-year-old child can write a letter and say, Dear President Obama, I think you're doing a great job or whatever. Usually somebody in the office will arrange for a letter to come back to you. So maybe there was a letter here, but I don't know. Huh? The president doesn't read it, but he has a staff in the White House that answers all the mail. And then they may bring something to his attention, Huh? Probably not. He's too busy, If there's too many, but there may not be too many letters, Yes, Rakshi Prabhu.
For Sankirtan that we were doing here in California. Yeah. And there was a lot of interest for devotees to send it. When we tried to get the address for it to go, you can say, of course, Governor Schwarzenegger. It goes to an office, a receiving office, that gets all the letters. There is some secretary who looks at it.
Right.
And often they use their own discretion whether they want to pass it on to the governor or not. So whether it will go to him or not is a question. Because it's quite possible that if it went to him, he may reply. He may say... Yeah. Please tell them this is very nice and you are doing and all that. But often it doesn't reach up. And I think Bali Mardan Prabhu had a good approach that when he wanted to do something with the mayor of San Jose, he directly got an appointment. He asked for an appointment, not a letter. And then he ended up telling him personally what he wanted to say and got a response. Of course, nice. It's not easy to get an appointment with the governor, but at least with the mayor of San Jose, that was done, and he gave him a Bhagavad Gita and everything.
Yeah.
So one has to try different strategies to do it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it may end up in an administrative office.
Yes. This letter is addressed to the president, the White House, Washington, D.C., 20202025. Then there was a second letter from 1976, I think. Because it mentions in the letter that it's the centennial, so it would have been Gerald Ford being the president at that time. Office of the President, dear sir, on your new $2 note, it is stated, "In God We Trust," and directly beneath, Declaration of Independence, 1776. On the 200th anniversary of this occasion, why not begin teaching the science of God, as described in the Vedic literatures, like the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is authorized and appreciated by all learned professors in the universities throughout the whole world. This Krishna consciousness movement is going on since 1966 throughout the whole world, especially in the United States of America. It is a great fortune for the American people that they trust in God. Why shouldn't this spiritual education be given to the American people in an organized way? The whole world is going down and becoming godless. If the American people who trust in God constitutionally take this movement seriously, it will be a great service to the human society. We are prepared to cooperate in this connection if the American government takes it very seriously. Awaiting your reply with interest, yours sincerely, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami. So anyway, Srila Prabhupada was writing these letters, and we can continue trying to, you know, in whatever way we can, trying to get whatever help is available. For example, we were noticing that, you know, as a religious organization is not allowed to get funding from a government agency because of the idea of secularism, but that, you know, there are things that we're teaching that are not specifically belonging to a sectarian religion, but are just, you know, philosophy, principle. You know, like, there's a soul, not the body, is a principle of philosophy. It could be a principle of education. Where exactly the lines merge or blend or divide from, you know, that which is education and that which is religion, you know, can be a changing contour, you know. But in the at least at the time of Maharaj Yudhishthira, it was clear that people who were actually enlightened, saintly people who had the qualities of saintly people, and who were learned in the authoritative Vedic scriptures, were respected as authorities. Scriptures may appear to contradict one another. You know, sometimes there's a famous verse from Mahabharata where Maharaj Yudhishthira says, "How does it go? Tarko pratishta." He says, "Logical argument is inconclusive. Shrutayo vibhinna." And the various scriptures may appear to contradict each other. And then he says, "Tarko pratishta shrutayo vibhinna na savrishir yasya matang nabhinnam." Nobody can be considered a great sage, a rishi or muni, unless his opinion is different from everyone else, unless he has his own opinion. Or we say in the modern university system, you know, you have to contribute something new to your field before you get a PhD. You have to do something that's actually a new, separate, different contribution that nobody thinks. And then he said, "Dharmasya tatvang nihitang guhayam." There's that word, confidential. The truth of religiosity, of real righteousness, is hidden within the hearts of saintly persons. And therefore, mahajano yena gatah sapan taha. That one must therefore actually take up the process of following in the footsteps of the great souls, the mahajans, who are actually saintly people. So, anyway, I'm sorry, you had a comment.
Prabhupada was in conversation telling, like, all the politicians has to attend Bhagavatam class every day before going to parliament.
They should attend before going to the parliament. They should attend Bhagavatam class every day.
It's mandatory for them, Prabhupada.
Yeah, this is a good proposal. They have, in the U.S. Congress, they recite a prayer, you know, "May God protect this Congress" or something. And in order to be secular, they've had, they've even had Hare Krishna devotees sometimes come and do the prayer, you know, so that it's not just a Christian all the time. They'll have Hindus, Muslims, Jews, and everything, which is nice, you know. But it would be good to actually sit and have a Bhagavatam class, non-sectarian class, where, you know, we can have saintly persons from Jewish and Christian and Muslim and Hindu backgrounds all sit and just discuss the principles of, you know, what is the soul, what is God, what is, you know, why do we believe in these things? Make everyone attend Bhagavatam class before. That's a good proposal.
Prabhu Hare Krishna. It came to me a story in Ramayana, I think history in Ramayana, like where once Romapad Maharaj, I think. So he, when he's giving a charity, he will stole a diamond from the Brahmin. And so the Brahmin came to know, "So you stole my diamond," so which is it's a priceless diamond. So then all the Brahmins left the country.
Who stole it?
The king stolen. Like king means king gave the charity. While giving the charity, he saw the it's a valuable diamond. Why should I give to a Brahman? Anyway, he'll give to charity to others. So I'll keep this diamond. I'll give all other diamonds to him. So the Brahman came to know, oh, king stolen that's supposed to give to me, but he stolen the diamond. So then he got angry, and all Brahmanas left the. I don't know which country it is. So he left that place, all the Brahmins. So when Brahmanas left, at that time there is no austerity, and it's a Yuga Dharma, and it's become a drought, and nobody was there, and all, like, everybody's starving. I think more than a couple of 14, 15 years like that. And then I think Rishi Sringa came. And I think Lord Ram have one brother, one sister. So Shanta, so he got married to Rishi Sringa, and then he performed penances like Yada Raja Tada Praja. It says from like what the king is.
So the
not
king had to solve the curse on the land because of his ancestors' insult to a Brahmana, and that caused the other Brahmanas to leave. And when the Brahmanas are not there, so this is the problem with Kali Yuga is, you know, that the Brahmanas, there aren't the qualified Brahmanas, and there aren't the qualified Kshatriyas either. Kalo Shudra Shambhava, really basically, we live in a time when we're all short-lived and lazy and misguided and unlucky and always disturbed, and everyone is fourth-class man or less. But this chanting of Hare Krishna is a great quality in this, you know, Kalo Dosha Nidhe Rajan, Asti hieka mahadgunan kirtanadeva krishnasya mukta sangha parang brajet. So this chanting of Hare Krishna is a very powerful and great benediction in this age. And now Lord Chaitanya has come. We're spreading this chanting. It will clean the hearts of all people. And then we'll see that the those in the positions of the intellectual leaders and the administrative leaders will also develop the necessary qualities somehow.
Even Prabhupada also, when he went to India, like after coming to US, he wrote a letter to Indira Gandhi saying that a widow should not rule the country. You should give to your son. You should... and she didn't like his idea.
But she was actually trying to meet him. He was like, in this letter, he was telling Nixon, I want to meet with you. And at one time, he got an audience with Indira Gandhi, but she didn't have much time for him. She was distracted. He could see she was distracted, and he didn't, because there was that was a time of emergency. She declared martial law, and he didn't want to, push her on spiritual topics too much. But later, before he passed away, she was trying to meet with him. But then at that time, he said, a sannyasi shouldn't meet a powerful state leader of state or something. He used that excuse to. So for whatever reason, he didn't want to meet anymore.
She only introduced this diverse system, Prabhu. Before that, there is no diverse in India. Like she introduced the diversing system, like, you know, this, like
divorce system. Okay.
Because at that time in Vedic system there is no divorce. Or
but among the Muslims there must be divorce. Yeah. Okay, yeah. But among Hindus there was no divorce until
it's
Indira
like,
Gandhi.
Legally. Legal.
It was Nehru who did it, huh? Oh, before her.
Property sharing. Indira Gandhi gave one part to the daughter. It was there in India. Like it was only for sons. Every property goes. Indira Gandhi adds daughter also some part to the property.
Yeah, the old English system was just the eldest son gets everything.
Oh, okay.
And then that's called primogeniture. That way it keeps the estates getting bigger and bigger, because if you have to give it to all of your children, then they all have to be divided again and again. Oh. But here we notice in this, I noticed that was something I didn't comment on because we should be ending, but I noticed in here that Srila Prabhupada was talking about how politicians, they stay in power as long as possible, even when they're old men, you know. And we hear that Maharaj Yudhishthir wanted to have a good heir so that he could then take sannyas and leave the kingdom in responsible hands. This is also a duty of ideal administrator, that he has to have He has to have to leave the state in good hands, and then he shouldn't just hang on to power till the end of his life or till some revolution tears him away or something like that, but should actually then, you know, having done his duty, you know, retire and practice purely spiritual activities in the end stage of his life. This is the Vedic system also for higher caste.
One final come.
Prabhuji, there's one more.
Okay, before we go, we've got Rakshit, we've got Krishna Purushottama, and we have Dharmadhar Vangshidhar.
I only have a small comment. That King Yudhishthir here is referring then to the future king, correct?
Parikshit Maharaj.
Who's
just been born, a little baby is born, and he's referring to what will the qualities of this child be.
Whether he will be a saintly king.
Yes.
Okay. So then, if he took sannyas or retired, it's in good hands.
Yeah. Yeah, he's not going to take sannyas right away. Parikshit Maharaj has to grow up first. But he wants to know that this is part of his responsibility, that you know, he doesn't just do a great deal when he's there, and then when he disappears, everything collapses.
Even I was just thinking about Indira Gandhi. Sorry for that. No, even she, she got blessings before she got a Prime Minister of India. She got blessings from one Shankaracharya descendants. So, and that is a sannyasi. He's very good in preaching of go, like, you know, like co-protection. Mm-hmm. So, and then at that time, I think Nehru only started slaughterhouses in India. Mm-hmm. He opened so many slaughterhouses when Nehru came as a Prime Minister. And then she is also promoting the slaughtering houses. And this saintly king wrote a letter, because of my blessings only you got a Prime Ministership. You should close all the slaughterhouses.
Mm-hmm.
But she never listened, and she's keep on postponing, saying that I just came into power now, I'll wait for some time, and postponing. And this sannyasi got very angry, and he also started a movement in I think Uttar Pradesh somewhere. And she put some gundas to kill that sannyasi on a Go Panchami day, and he got shooted. That sannyasi got shooted.
He got shot. Huh?
Yeah, shot. And he, while dying, he gave a curse. You also die like a bullet shot. And and Indira Gandhi died on Go Panchami day, and she also got like a bullet shot. So this is one guy researched probably. I think his name is Rajiv Dikshit.
Okay.
And he's a follower of Mahatma Gandhi. And he briefed this story to me.
Interesting. Okay, so on the phone we have Damodar.
Prabhuji, just again, you know, talking of Indira Gandhi, because I think my Guru Maharaj forwarded one of the note. Actually, it was because Indira Gandhi used to live in Allahabad, where Srila Prabhupada is for Prayag Pharmacy. And at the age till 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12, the Jawaharlal Nehru and she used to visit Srila Prabhupada's pharmacy to get the medicine. And Prabhupada used to call, Indu, and was very affectionate. She had a lot of conversation. There is actually one writing from Guru Maharaj which was circulated. So I just thought, and then later when she got into power, Srila Prabhupada probably was trying to preach her basically. But, you know, and it relates to what you said in the beginning. So, but in the beginning, they were very close. I think they used to go and get medicines from Srila Prabhupada, because Srila Prabhupada used to get medicines from some chemical factory from Calcutta. While selling the medicine. And that medical shop is still around, Prabhuji. This time I went and I was trying to buy that, but, you know, I could not get. Probably next time we'll get something.
So Pandit Nehru and his daughter would come to the Prabhupada's pharmacy shop sometimes, and they knew him. Okay, I didn't know that.
True.
That's very interesting.
And it was
small world,
by
you know?
B.R. Sridhar Maharaj Swami. Yeah.
Say that again?
I am just reading my Guru Maharaj. The following is from the transcript of conversation with Srila Prabhupada's godbrother, Srila B.R. Sridhar Maharaj. Swami Maharaj refers to Srila Prabhupada, and he was talking with, someone, and, you know, there's a whole conversation which, so I'll forward it to you.
Yeah, well, of course, Srila Prabhupada was everywhere. He was interested in meeting with government leaders to ask them to help the movement. You know, the movement was, you know, struggling and new. And like in India, people were saying, oh, all these foreigners are coming here. Why are they coming here? They must be CIA people and they must be... And, you know, Prabhupada wanted to get them visas, you know, and be allowed to come and work there and stuff. And but similarly, he said that this is, we should engage all the government leaders in somehow helping us, you know, like we should get, at least we should get permits for to hold festivals like we have at Rath Yatra in San Francisco. The mayor will come and, you know, Willie Brown came and swept in front of the Rath Yatra cart and stuff like that. And this is nice. The government should support this movement because, and Prabhupada would point out, because of this movement, the young people who are taking drugs and getting involved in crime and getting involved in bad activities and things like that, they're becoming cured and becoming better. So we're, you know, we are, and I think people in the United States, they look to religious organizations, volunteerism, religious organizations to provide charity and support for people, people who are in all kinds of having distress. They may have drug addiction problems or gambling addiction problems or family problems and things like that, and they expect to go and be able to get guidance from a clergyman. And so it's seen that spiritual organization does a lot of important benefits in any society. And the Hare Krishna movement should also be have a good reputation that we are actually, we're not just here to, you know, asking, begging for the government to give us something. Like you see in Srila Prabhupada's letter, he was saying, I'm doing something, you know, I'm making a generation of Americans into the flowers of their country. They're giving up their bewildered drug problems, their illicit sexual connection, becoming disciplined and clear-thinking people that can actually help their country. And we should continue that. We should continue to make our devotees into successful people.
I just wanted to make one comment with respect to this, that it's a very difficult proposition to directly approach government and ask them to support a religious organization. Like in the United States especially, because you have this separation of church from the state.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, if they supported the Hare Krishnas, the Christians would say, well, how come you're supporting Hare Krishna?
Right.
We have these other organizations.
Except so, the Christians are saying you should support Christians.
Yeah, exactly.
So we could say, the government can say, well, I can support Christians only if I also support Hare Krishnas. They say that sometimes. You know, in fact, that's the people... But I'm yes. Sorry, interrupted you.
So it's a dilemma for the government,
mm-hmm.
because you have multiple religions in the country. But there was this mechanism that was created under George Bush with his faith-based religions,
yeah.
through which they felt they could support those governments who were doing community service and things like
charitable
that.
Work.
And maybe that is a way out of this.
It's really true that in constitutional law, the First Amendment, the Establishment Clause that says that the Congress shall make no law concerning the establishment of religion, it had traditionally for a long time been interpreted that although the government couldn't favor one church over another church, it could in general favor religion as opposed to non-religion. But then during the 60s and some of the school... litigation about, you know, teaching evolution and things like that. In fact, far past the time that it was even relevant, because nobody was, of course, it became more relevant again later, but nobody was, like in the Scopes trial in the 1920s, the government had made it actually a crime to teach evolution in the school. And then Mr. Scopes was a school teacher who defied the law, taught, and then he was prosecuted for the crime, and there was a big... public trial with Clarence Darrow supporting the defendant and William Jennings Bryan, an important politician who ran for president a few times, and he supported the law. But of course, that law was, you know, that's in the 1920s and it was really archaic. But in the 1960s, there was a case anyway that they started to interpret the Establishment Clause to say that atheism has to also be given equal.
atheism has to be given equal reverence to any religion, and therefore that any idea of God is religious. And that Abe Fortas wrote the opinion. I forget the name of the actual case. But there's, you know, there is this tradition within constitutional law to argue what does secularism in the American constitutional context mean, and there is a long and rich tradition, and the conservatives in America support the idea that government should be able to support, you know, religion and faith as long as it's not one religion over another religion. You know, we can't say that in America has become a Catholic country or a Baptist country or a Presbyterian country or an Episcopal country or a Hindu or Jewish or Muslim or Buddhist country. But that the idea, you know, it still says in God we trust on the money, but there are people who agitate that it shouldn't say that because that supports religion. And so there's those debates are going on. And stuff, and we could become interested and expert in those debates.
We have one success story in India. Like, we invited all the big MLAs and MPs, and Maharaj gave a very good lecture saying that, you know, a leader should take care of cows and protect cows. So he immediately gave 80 acres of land.
Oh, 80 acres of land.
It's a huge property.
Oh, nice.
Next day, he just signed off the. Very impressed with the lecture.
So who gave the land?
Government gave.
The government.
Yeah.
So it was just some government land and that they had available to give.
It's very fertile land and it's near to the water facility, everything there. So we have the property and we have cows now.
So it's possible. But it's one possible. Comment, we have to wrap up, but I was thinking that one comment I had about Prabhupada writing these letters is that, I mean, it almost, to us it almost sounds, you know, you think, oh, it's naive that he's writing and thinking that the government can do something for the Hare Krishnas. Doesn't he know that it's secular? He knows. It's not, but he's showing the example of, you know, they may have their own ideas or whatever, but if he sticks to the actual principle that, you know, I'm a spiritual teacher and I'm asking them to do their duty and support spiritual teacher, so he's setting a precedent for so that for future generations we can talk about in these Bhagavatam classes how you know, saintly kings or saintly government should actually support genuine spiritual teachers. And it's not to say that only Hare Krishnas are genuine and no other religion is genuine or anything like that. That's not our point. But people should know about Bhagavad Gita. Everybody should respect Bhagavad Gita is genuine. It's very famous. He mentions it in and Srimad Bhagavatam, he mentions in the letters. So he mentions Bhagavad Gita in the first letter, I think, and Srimad Bhagavatam in the second letter. But so we should understand this principle and then find ways to apply the principle that are practical. You know, it may not be practical to actually expect. Yeah, so in the first letter he says, you know, that there was a descendant of the Kuru dynasty on the throne. He ruled over the whole planet as the emperor of the whole planet. He was the grandson of Arjuna, who was the hero of the Bhagavad Gita and the personal associate of Lord Sri Krishna. And in the second letter, he said, why not begin teaching the science of God as described in the Vedic literatures like the Srimad Bhagavatam? And that's, you know, that is something different about, you know, a lot of the, at least about a lot of the Christians you'll find when you talk to them and stuff like that, that part of their concept of Christianity is it's only Christianity and nobody else, no Muslims, no, it's like... the idea that we're in this group and we're fighting against other groups, you know, and Muslims are very much like that, you know, that we're fighting against infidels. It's almost a central theme, you know, of, you know, God supported our group and then didn't support anybody who worshipped anybody else but Allah, and He's God, and if you're not with us, you're against us. And this one thing about this, you know, Bhagavad Gita is how universal it is, and Srimad Bhagavatam, that these are just talking about, these are the principles. Well, all right, forget about which group you're in. What is God? What are the qualities of God? You know, we have a scripture that says God is Bhagavan. He has all these opulences in full, you know, so this is a principle, you know. What we can talk about these things in terms of, we could say, neutral philosophical principles that don't, you know. And our tradition is quite comfortable with that. And there was a Newsweek article about 6 months ago or a year ago saying America is becoming Hindu. And it's America's becoming Hindu. And when you read the article, it said, no, we don't mean that they go and, you know, worship Ganesh and light incense or anything like that. But we mean that the attitude is, it used to be that religion was about which church you belong to or which denomination you belong to. And now it's, what Prabhupada's attitude used to, it was quite a revolutionary attitude when we heard it from Prabhupada in the 1970s, was, you know, it doesn't matter which church you belong to, it matters, are you getting the result? Are you learning how to become lover of God? You know, that's the practical, it's a practical thing. And now the American attitude is becoming more like that, that if you go to a Presbyterian church or you go to a Baptist church, but if you get the real thing, if you get the experience of love of God, then it's, you're successful.
You're Rakshit. Talking about the science of God consciousness.
Yes. Microphone.
Because the underlying theme here of what Srila Prabhupada was arriving at and giving this non-sectarian knowledge is addressing the science of God consciousness, which should have universal principles and should resonate in everyone.
Yes.
It's not connected to Islam or Christianity or Hinduism. They are the universal principles of God consciousness.
Yeah.
So there is merit to that, that teaching of that can help everyone.
Yeah, Prabhupada often referred to this as Krishna consciousness as a science. And what does it mean it's a science? As someone actually wrote me and asked me, Satyaraj was writing and asked me, give me one paragraph or two paragraphs on what does it mean Krishna consciousness is a science? Because obviously it doesn't mean that it adopts the empirical scientific method or something like that. But it's a description, a factual description of reality. It's systematic. It's philosophical. And you know, the mood now in the world, because of the way, you know, empirical science has developed it, that is, as the idea that to be true, for something we believe, for us to believe in, it has to meet these criteria of being objectively perceivable by the senses and you know, subject to, you know, hypotheses that can be disproved by experiments, you know, and under certain conditions and so forth. Whereas, so that it's not that kind of science, actually. In fact, it's a deeper science that challenges this epistemology, that says that, you know, pratyaksha and anumana, that is, direct perception and logic, have to take an inferior position to, you know, Vedic Shabda, actually hearing from perfect authority. Now, there may be a question of what perfect authority is, but it's not anti-philosophical. You know, there's sometimes, like the Southern Baptists have sometimes you see a bumper sticker that says, God said it, I believe it, that settles it. You know, in a sense, that's also what we're saying, but not in that way, that we're not, Prabhupada said, you know, religion without philosophy is fanaticism. Or you know, it's mental speculation. No, I'm sorry. It was full. No, that's a different thing. He said philosophy without religion is speculation. Or you're saying philosophy, but a religion without philosophy is sentiment, just sentiment or fanaticism, and so that, you know, really understanding, real worship of God requires understanding of God. Why do you do what you do? How does it work? Why, you know, and it's factual. We're dealing with something that's factual. You may not be able to see it at first, or you may have to have a change of heart before you can see it. But that doesn't mean it's not. That doesn't mean that it's not true. We're dealing with the absolute truth, and there has to be an absolute truth beyond all the relative truths, and. So this is something that's, it's very radical. It's very striking at the root of a lot of just assumptions that have developed over hundreds of years and give rise to the assumptions of, you know, egalitarianism, democracy, secularism, and all these principles that we shouldn't just make fun of. People hold them very dear. They're protections against tyranny, protections against fanatics, protections against other things. I mean, you know... who is in favor of theocracy these days? Right now, when I was a kid growing up, at least as an American, the big conflict in the world was, you know, capitalism versus, you know, versus communism, you know, or democracy, as we would want to phrase it. You know, like people who are in favor of, you know, procedural justice of, you know, rights, as opposed to people who are in favor of economic justice in terms of not some people being too wealthy and some people being too poor. And there was this big conflict. But with the breakup of the Soviet Union and everything, that's taken more of a back burner. And the big conflict now that everybody perceives is the Islamists who want a theocratic state, you know, and that's become the big issue because there's the, you know, 9/11 and this, the different random acts of terrorist violence. People want to to build again another caliphate, you know, of where there was supposedly a saintly king. You know, Muhammad was a king, and then the first four descendants of his caliphs or whatever were, you know, they were the kings and also the leaders of the spiritual leaders of the Islamic world. And then there were all the different sects. Like the Sunnis broke off very early when the son of Ali, Hussein, was ambushed and stuff. You know, and it's all in recent history. It's only 1,300 years ago or something. Where I was going with that is that the ideas of people wanting a saintly, and people do naturally want a saintly king who can also teach principles of religion, but there's a fear that anybody who's a religious leader who has too much political power is going to be a religious fanatic and a tyrant and a bully and things like that. So we have to recognize that fear and understand it and. But at the same time, we should recognize that the Srimad Bhagavatam teaches these underlying, you know, principles. And we should have lots of discussion about these things and lots of, yes, Prabhu, Sunny Prabhu. We should stop soon. I know I'm excited, I'm going on.
Religion with the, this when we, religion is focusing to the philosophy and the principles. Oftentimes in the history we saw that we are losing that real part of the bhakti. The bhakti is the important thing. Philosophy, if the philosophers and speculators often lose that part of the bhakti. So yeah. when the bhakti is there, the knowledge, jnana, is also there.
Yes.
So even without that bhakti, we cannot to even get to the anuman.
Right.
Otherwise, you will be in the pratyaksha. You know, whatever it is in here, enjoy it, that's it.
Or you become mayaya paritikyana.
Yes. So the smoke is in the mountain, upon the mountain, then we know there's a fire.
Yeah.
You know, even though we that's didn't anuman. See the agni really, yeah. We know there's the agni in there because the smokes, we are here.
Yeah.
We are seeing that.
Yeah.
So the bhakti is the important thing than the philosophy and the principle.
Uh-huh.
Because when you are involved with the philosophy and the principles, we are oftentimes backing off or losing that real part of the bhakti.
Yeah. So that's important. The bhakti has to be there. The chanting of Hare Krishna every day, we have to follow. You know, it's really bhakti is the real thing. But jnana is will help support bhakti. Jnana and vairagya are supporting of bhakti, actually. They're in and of themselves, they have no value. But if someone doesn't have sufficient jnana and vairagya, then they won't remain strong in bhakti generally.
Again, the real true meaning of jnana is also coming from the byproduct of the bhakti.
Yes. Yeah, you're right. And that's what I was saying. Vasudeve bhagavati bhakti yoga prayojitaha janayadyashu vairagyam jnanam cha yadahaitukam, which means that when one has bhakti, then automatically jnana and vairagya, they're concomitant factors. They come automatically along with bhakti. And then without bhakti, naishkarmyam apyachuta bhava varjitam nashobhate jnanam alang naranjana. Without a concept of the infallible Supreme Personality of Godhead, then even the liberated condition, free from karma, it doesn't look well. And then what to speak of, Narada Muni says, what to speak of, you know, fruitive religion that's done for some material gain. You know, that it has to, so he's telling Vyasadeva to compose the great work on bhakti, Srimad Bhagavatam. So yes, bhakti is supreme. Bhakti is our, you know, is the goal, it's the essence of all religion. But at the same time, people may, in the name of bhakti, violate principles of knowledge and principles of religion, and that becomes a disturbance to society. Shruti smriti purana adi pancharatra vidhimbina aikantaki hirer bhakti utpadayaiva kalpate. So we don't want to say oh, forget the regular principles, it's just bhakti, because then what we get is sahajas who don't really have real bhakti, but they take everything cheaply. Or, you know, fanatics who say bhakti means joining my group and my camp, and if you're not, we're going to, you know, spread, you know, we're not going to spread ISKCON by the sword, so to speak. You know, we're spreading ISKCON by preaching and chanting and enlightening people within their hearts, and not this kind of fanatical, you have to join our group. No, you may have bhakti in your own group, but you should recognize that bhakti and appreciate it.
The reason I was saying gopis and the cowherd boys, the gopalas, they didn't have education. Simple, yeah. They didn't have any kind of education.
And they were more perfect. Yeah.
They were, you know, they were.
Some of those gopis were actually rishis. Yeah. In the time of Ramchandra, and yeah. Some of them were actually Vedas personified. They had become gopis.
Yes. So in that regular kind of education, they didn't have that, you know. They didn't have any math or anything. They just, you know, having cows and selling milks and making butter and that kind of life.
Yes.
But they got it, but the philosophers didn't have that, you know.
Yeah. So that's important. Bhakti is, if we can please Krishna, that's the highest thing. And Krishna's more pleased by someone's simple person's pure love than he is by a very educated person or a very wealthy person who doesn't have that pure love. But at the same time, we should fortify ourselves with understanding of all these things and in the proper perspective and being able to explain them to others by actually realizing them ourselves. Otherwise, the movement won't be able to actually spread bhakti very effectively. And we won't be able to remain in bhakti very effectively, because if we don't have a strong philosophical foundation, beginners like us, you know, for gopis that's one thing, they're automatically attracted to Krishna. But beginners like us who are attracted to material enjoyment, if we don't have a foundation in philosophy, we may not, you know, our mind may drag us away from bhakti.
And we also know that
microphone.
He's a rare soul. Bahunam janmanam gnante gnanavan mam prapadyante vasudev sarvam miti mahatma sudurlaba. Krishna is saying he's that rare soul who, after many, many births, having all this knowledge, finally comes to the realization that Vasudev is everything and surrenders. And such a soul is rare. At the same time, there are others who may be suspicious of bhakti or may not know, but through this knowledge and understanding, association with devotees, they can come into devotional service. So that process also has to be there, rather than just the point blank part that, oh, take on bhakti and that is the only thing.
There's four kinds of pious people, but they're not pure devotees. They're pious people. The gopis are pure devotees. They're in a different category. They're already spontaneously attracted. There's four kinds of pious people who come to Krishna: those who are desiring wealth, those who are in distress, those who are curious, you know, inquisitive, and those who are actually wise people. And then Krishna says of those four, the wise people are actually favored by him. They're the best. They have the most chance of actually becoming the pure, the completely pure. They're not coming. Out of those four, the wise ones, the jnanis, they're not coming for something else, you know, to get some, you know, the distressed people, relieve my distress. Those who are after wealth, you know, make me wealthy, you know. Those who are inquisitive, I want knowledge, you know, I want some. But the jnanis already have knowledge, they're peaceful, and they're able to then come to the higher platform of, I want you to be happy, Krishna. I want to serve Krishna. But then you're right that there are also four kinds of impious people, and they may be very intelligent. Mayaya paritakyana, asurang bhavam. They may be a big atheist or a big intelligent person whose knowledge is stolen by maya. So you're right that when we say, part of the knowledge is knowledge that bhakti is more important than knowledge, right? Jnana karmadya navritam. What is the definition of pure devotional service? It says, anya abhilashita shunyam jnana karmadya navritam. So there's two things. Karma, you want some fruit. Jnana, generally, you want to know everything. And so you want to become one with God. So pure devotional service is free from any desire for jnana or desire for karma or desire for the fruits of karma. And then anukulyena, and it has to be Krishnanu Shilanam. It has to be favorable to Krishna and Anyabhilash, nothing else. Nothing else but that. Krishna, service to Krishna. And then Anukulyena Krishnanu Shilanam Bhakti Rutumam. That's the high, that's real high bhakti. And it does, you're right, it doesn't depend on jnana. In fact, it surpasses jnana. But until we get there, you know, in the fourth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, you know, you can do different kinds of sacrifices, sacrifices of your wealth, sacrifices of, you know, different things of your, you know, controlling your senses, different, but the sacrifice that's done in knowledge and spiritual knowledge, understanding that I'm not this body, that there is a supreme absolute truth, and then there's the soul, and, you know, that sacrifice in knowledge is better than the sacrifice merely of your possessions or of your time and your attention. So, so anyway, all these things have to be understood in proper perspective. Very, you're very right, Sunny, that bhakti is the highest thing, and it's not dependent on jnana or detachment. But bhakti is like synonymous with detachment. If you become attached to serving Krishna, automatically you lose interest in the material things, and you also lose interest in becoming proud of your knowledge. You know, Granthara Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.